ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I think I can get used to this. Where were you when the moon landing happened, and where were you when the minefield finally did a Q&A episode? Welcome to it. We try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. We'll lead Ali's. My name's Scott Stevens is my co. Why are you looking at me like this, Scott?
I just realised, to my horror, I'm going to feel bereft next week. I'll be standing in studio, the music will start playing, I'm waiting for people to immediately applaud my presence.
It's okay, because the good thing is we've recorded this applause, and so you can just play it to yourself anytime you like. You can hear this. When you get up in the morning, for example, when you walk down for breakfast. Yo, Scott! Apparently, that's the breakfast applause.
Is that it?
That's okay. Apparently what it was. So it's weird because we've never done anything like this before. And do you want to say anything about that before we launch into the topic? Or do you just want to launch in? Because to me, I feel like we're crossing a Rubicon here. You don't think so?
It just sounds like much more pretentious than I thought.
Oh, sorry. Fair enough.
So last week, we devoted an hour to discussing the phenomenon of the wisdom of crowds. How much credence should we give the notion of the wisdom of crowds? Let me put this another way. How much credence should we give the judgment of the wisdom of crowds? And one of the things that's crucial to the idea of the wisdom of crowds is the idea of wisdom. The term is chosen very deliberately because we're familiar with the irrationality of crowds. We're familiar with ideas like herd behavior, with people responding to emotions and not really thinking about long-term consequences, people engaging in knee-jerk reactions to things and simply following a dominant group. These are all ideas that we associate with crowds. We don't associate crowds with wisdom. And as soon as you associate wisdom with crowds, what you're trying to indicate, I think, is that there is something about the process of determination whereby crowds reach their decision that accords to something true, that accords to something right. Even if it's not finally right, let's just put it this way, it's proximately right. In other words, it's a step in the right direction.
Would you say it's circumstantially right?
It could be circumstantially right, which could also mean it's circumstantially wrong.
Well, in different circumstances?
No.
I almost understood you.
Hannah Arendt was very skeptical about the role of truth in a democracy.
Yeah.
As soon as truth is used too much, that means there is a particular notion that people need to comport themselves to, tie themselves to. In other words, terrible atrocities have been committed in the name of truth. We don't need to go much further down. Revolutions have taken place in the name of truth. In the name of truth, entire populations have been replaced by another. So Arendt, I think, in the name of opposing totalitarianism, was rightly skeptical about truth claims within a democracy. Democracies don't deal in truth, she said, which means that a decision can be a good decision in the current circumstances. If it's a bad decision, all is not lost. It just means that you can look back 10 years' time and you realize we got that one wrong. We took the wrong fork in the road at that point. And thankfully, democracy is all about second chances.
So hang on, are you saying then that the wisdom of crowds, such as it exists, can only be measured long-term?
The wisdom of crowds can, in most circumstances, yes, be measured in the long-term.
How long-term?
Yeah.
Could you say, well, we really took the wrong road 200 years ago when we enacted X constitution or Y system of government, or like at what point?
Yeah. Look, I don't think it needs to be that kind of long term. This is one of the reasons I think that the regularity, the drumbeat of significant democratic moments is important. The regularity of democratic moments, democratic events, is what stops elections being fought along apocalyptic lines. If we lose this, an entire way of life is in jeopardy. Instead, what democracy, what faith in the ability of the other side to govern me. Faith in the ability of the majority that I'm not a part of to govern me. What makes that tolerable are two things. Firstly, all is not lost. The next time is coming around. And the other idea is, in the interim, in this hiatus, when I am on the wrong side of the majority, this is my opportunity to see the world through their eyes. To see the world through what George Katev, a wonderful political philosopher, calls the particular coloration of the other side of politics. I get to see the world through their hues, through their lenses. I can see the different parts of the elephant, as Stephanie referred to last week. So that's one of the things that the wisdom of crowds, even if they're not always wise, the time frame within which the decision-making of crowds gives us the opportunity to either rectify our decisions or to simply see the world through the alternative light that those, say, wrong decisions or hasty decisions or skewed decisions, if, say, a demagogue got in the way and swayed the crowd in a particular direction. So let me propose a kind of governing idea that might help stitch together what we're talking about over the next hour. Plato said that there are three types of disputes, and here we're getting a little bit away from politics. Plato said that there are three types of disputes that rouse the anger of the citizens of a city. There are disputes over the right and the wrong. Those are fairly easy ones because there's a clear answer. You just need to inform enough people, and that decision, it might create proximate feelings of anger, but once enough education has taken place, then that dispute is fairly easily resolved. There are disputes over the just and the unjust. What is the claim of justice over our common life? What does it mean to be just in the circumstance, not just to be powerful? But then it's this final option, the final kind of dispute that I've always found the most interesting. It's the dispute between the honorable and the dishonorable. How do you quantify that? What is honorable and what is dishonorable? That's a debate over different ways of living, different structures of value. Honorable and dishonorable is a debate over that's beautiful. No, it's not.
It's also a debate over different ways of regarding.
That's right, yes. That,
what's the import of that? That's ultimately an insoluble debate because it's so shot through with irreconcilable and, I don't know, unjusticiable subjectivities that this becomes simply a matter of numbers, power, or not the stuff of politics.
Okay. So when honorable and dishonorable becomes a matter of majority, that's really problematic, isn't it? Imagine that a particular way of life, say a romantic relationship between two people of the same gender, is regarded as dishonorable by the majority. Is that just? Isn't that precisely the kind of thing that we don't want to leave up to the rule of the majority? So it might simply be romantic. It can also be categories of beauty. It can also be systems of value. This is worth something. That is not worth sacrificing for the sake of the life of a city. This is a way of living that is proper, that is appropriate, that regards the dignity, the humanity, the beauty of other human beings. This is a way of living that does not, that treats those various things badly. Now, when you accord those sorts of things to majority, then that's where conformity becomes the operative dynamic.
You're really just using another language to talk about rights.
No.
I think you are, because that's what ultimately that comes down. Where you start to say majority will has no say here, it is indecent, or it is unjust, or it is somehow wrong.
Ugly.
Whatever adjective you want to use. That shouldn't be operative here. That is the basis on which rights are asserted, right? Like when I mean rights in the sense of like human rights or some kind of inalienable right, they are asserted on the basis that if the majority differs here, they are just wrong. Okay. Framing that as honour and dishonour.
Yeah, see, I'm not going anywhere near the discourse of rights here.
But I think you inevitably then
rights,
end there.
Rights is what we're talking about when it's the just and the unjust. Before rights are brought into play, with, say, the status of certain types of human relationship. There's something even before rights that has to be overcome. And that's the feeling of, say, disgust. The primary thing that stood in the way, for instance, of anti-miscegenation laws being overturned in the United States was the feeling of disgust. It wasn't a matter of rights. It was the majority regards this as disgusting, this as vulgar, this as not proper for proper society. So you might want to talk in terms of rights. For me, the operative question here is when the majority has agreed on a particular thing being beautiful, proper, an indication of, say, civilized or enlightened life, and a minority regards it as conformist, oppressive, not recognizing the inherent beauty that is in fact at play. What we're talking about there isn't the assertion of rights, but the possibility of productive or constructive dissent. So here I think we can take this particular part of the conversation in two directions. One is, if everybody says that Oppenheimer is a terrific movie and it has an 87% Rotten Tomatoes rating, and some of us think that it was a vulgar instance of pretend high-mindedness where its artificial intelligence was demonstrated by somebody reading the four quartets of T.S. Eliot and having Albert Einstein walk on stage and including a bit of fanciful conspiratorial BS, casting it in black and white.
For example.
But that kind of dissent, not trying to take the fun out of things, but there is kind of a criteria of value here that's being lost in the rush towards so many people giving this kind of rating to that kind of movie. So one of the things that makes the wisdom of crowds, especially if we think of it in terms of its deliberative, interpersonal aspect, not just where people happen to land, but the process by which we persuade one another, we tell one another that this is good. The only thing that I think can make the wisdom of crowds legitimate, give it any credence whatsoever, is the extent to which it allows for strident dissent in its face, which is another way of saying before the decision, in which the wisdom of crowds or the lack of demonstrates itself, before the decision, there needs to be genuine deliberation. There needs to be, if you've all seen the movie 12 Angry Men, Sidney Lumet, 1957, there needs to be that one juror, juror number 8, who says, I don't think he's guilty, in order for the rest of the deliberation to take place. There needs to be that one critic. By the way, you should all read Christos Tsolkas' review of Oppenheimer. It was a masterpiece. Masterpiece. There needs to be that one critic that says, I know you all like this, but there's an important value here that you're missing. There's something that's aesthetically beautiful that you're passing over here in your rush to give it its accolades. Now, there are ways for a critic like that to be simply a grump. I know that you all like Taylor Swift, but it's because your aesthetic sensibilities are far too unrefined. In other words, the kind of critic that takes the pleasure out of things. And then there's the critic who, in order for people to enjoy that, to be able to say, but in your rush to the concert, don't forget, take a little bit of time.
So, you didn't go to the concert, did you?
I didn't, of course I didn't. So it's not a matter of fault finding. But one of the things about a crowd is that it can, in fact, gain speed.
Hmm. Well, this is the sporting crowd thing.
It can take on a life of its own. And that's why, for that to have any credence whatsoever, the wisdom of crowds has got to allow for the possibility of the minority of one that then becomes the deliberative conditions of a new majority, either before the decision or in the form of post-decision dissent.
So it's an important point. On the subject of gaining speed, we're about 10 minutes late to people's questions. So we should get on and do that. But we can't proceed without re-inviting, I think, is that the right word?
Re-inviting.
Our guest from last week. We're very happy to have her. Would you please welcome Stephanie Collins? Would you like to have a quick ambit before we open to the floor?
I want to draw on John Rawls for a second, which isn't very popular. I kind of want to draw a distinction between what he called conceptions of the good, so how a human might choose to live their life. You don't like Oppenheimer. People should be allowed to go. You shouldn't get in the way of the Oppenheimer people. I'm not saying you would never do that. But if some people's conception of the good life includes going to see Oppenheimer 15 times, that should be allowed to kind of flourish. I think we should be careful in political life to besmirch anyone's conception of the good life, right? So I'm all for, again, pluralism there. I think in politics we should be very hesitant to judge people's conceptions of the good. But then it's also important in political life, and this is, again, just rules, that you have some sort of basic standards that you all agree on. And this is like maybe what Waleed was getting at. I think you're kind of alluding to like liberal rights or human rights that you kind of need to have in place in order for these different conceptions of the good to flourish. And those shouldn't be negotiable. So I kind of want to say, the Oppenheimer thing, yeah, let a thousand flowers bloom. Like, that's your conception of the good. Go for it, as long as you're not harming anyone. But also, yeah, really important that we have this background system, call them what you want, liberal rights, human rights, that allows these different conceptions of the good to flourish as the beautiful thousand flowers that they are. I quite liked the movie,
just as a slightly... you're dead to me. Just as a slight little coda to that, though, I mean, when we're talking about different conceptions of the good, their roles is, in fact, getting very, very close to the idea of the honorable and the dishonorable. Because it's not just political life. It is also fully social life and the way in which we live together and the way, I mean, what most people don't recognize or forgotten about Rawls's theory of justice is that crucial final portion of the book is devoted to something as concrete and pragmatic as what he described as the political sentiments, the political emotions, like envy, contempt, anxiety, even all the things that when allowed to flourish within a, forget political community, a society, a body, can in fact undermine the conditions within which people live together. I think one of the ways of framing that, and this maybe brings us back to the critic's point, a critic might want to say, everybody might like that movie, I don't. But the first question that the critic should be asking herself is, what are they seeing that I'm missing?
Which is the point we made about referenda, plebiscites, etc. I understand that. I'm just a bit floored that what we've ended up with really is just an articulation of the virtues of liberalism.
That's where we need to bring the audience in. Right. Maybe they all...
But that's all that's happened here, right?
Undermine it. Yeah, I'm a liberal.
Let's not have a unifying conception of the good. Let's let a thousand flowers bloom. Let's have it buttressed by certain rights. Which kinds of rights? Oh, liberal rights. Okay. So we're just articulating liberalism here. I find that an odd place for us to have ended up on, given we're up to, 10 years of critiquing liberalism as an organising principle for society.
But that's not quite where we are, Willie.
I think it is.
Coming to see the world gradually through the eyes of others.
That point I agree with. But I think we've coloured it in far more than that. I think the way we've coloured it in there makes the notion of having these arguments around a conception of the good just about impossible. Because really what ends up happening is, don't yuck my yum, right? The language of the good is now inadmissible in this context.
Not inadmissible, just we can still debate whether it was a good movie, I think. We're allowed to have that conversation. No, we're not. Scott's shaking his head. But it's just that we don't kind of, honourable and dishonourable, we don't accuse our opponents of being dishonourable for disagreeing.
I get that. But that only goes so far once you're not talking about movies. Because actually, if you have a strong, like a thick conception of the good, which I don't think we can deny people because that might ultimately be what life's about, then to say, well, now I'm not going to hold you dishonourable because your conception of the good is so at odds with...
No, that's
a hard thing.
What I think we are resisting is the idea of the good that can be opposed, that can be imposed by the conformist will of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking at several points about the importance of time. The importance of time within democratic communities, the importance of time in the process of deliberation. A shared sense of the good is something that develops with time.
Okay.
Is something that can accumulate.
Only though, if you have a political discussion or a form of social deliberation that is capable or conversant with discussing things at that level.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't think we do. And I think one of the reasons we don't is that that becomes too antagonistic, perhaps even agonistic.
That's why I resist the introduction of rights the way that you did before. Okay.
You were right to tell me I was wrong in that case then, Scott. I think you might actually have been. This is Minefield History, the first ever questions.
We've never broadcast
this. This has never happened. For the most part, we think it's best that the crowd be left out of it. But we're ready to go. Yes.
Hi, my name is Wendy. I'm wondering, what do you think are the right conditions for the wisdom of the crowd to come to the fore? And how can we create those conditions more often?
I think this is a Stephanie question, actually.
Oh, gosh, it can be. I'm going to rant on about mini publics again, which I did last week, so I won't refer you to that and I won't go back to that. I mean, other than those kind of structured, proper consultations with the public rather than just consultation window dressing, right? So other than kind of those properly structured sort of mini publics, I mean, this is so boring, but I think the answer is education. education in primary schools and high schools and better working conditions for teachers. I think that kind of stuff is a large part of where public discourse is falling down. I also think there's a real problem with the regulation of social media. I mean, that's an international issue, not just a domestic issue, because these companies are international, right? So it's very hard for any one state to do anything. But that's going to be another part of it. I mean, I think there's a lot of factors, but those are two.
Can I add three very quick things? Number one, what she said is why we should lower the voting age for children.
Oh, did you? guys, we went as young as, like, did we go to six? We went to 12 before.
Yes, I've heard 12.
Yeah.
That's in the literature, yeah.
We teach kids to deliberate and to lose early. So voting and what we're doing in schools, I think, is vitally, vitally important. Number one. Number two is the media, to say nothing of social media, can't be the only game in town. There is something about deliberating with people in remote settings through the sterility of the screen that tends to turn the person on the other side of that screen, not to another participant, co-participant in this shared project of our common life, but turns them into an avatar. Plus, I think that Rousseau's fear of the distorting effect of demagogues, kind of marshalling people, channeling them, so that hearing something that kind of approximates my opinion, but hearing it so much louder through the voice of that person who says it so much more articulately than I do, there's something about that that takes an opinion that might have been sincere and constructive and turns it into performance. So media cannot be the only game in town when it comes to deliberation. Media is indispensable, but it can't be the only game in town. The final thing, when we set out to persuade someone, you know what we really want? We want to know that they've been persuaded. How do we want to know it? We want them to make a public declaration. We want them to back down. We want to see them change their mind. That's not the way that it works. When we are involved in deliberation with other people, there are tiny invisible accommodations that are taking place all the time. Here's my third point. We need to give people the ability to save face even when they change their mind.
Can I add something to this? I take Stephanie's point about education. I am, however, skeptical of the possibilities of it for a couple of reasons. One is I'm not sure actually a lot of our deliberative problems are about education. They're about more abstract, perhaps intangible matters of the heart. And so for that reason, I'm not opposed to education, and I'm definitely not opposed to teachers being better supported, better resourced, etc. But I don't feel it's a panacea. Something to pick up though from what Scott said, and I'm pretty sure Scott would agree with this because we wrote an essay to this effect. To me, the proper conditions for a crowd or a public to arrive at something insightful, something true, something optimal is when the public actually is capable of understanding itself and each other. And so a point that Scott and I made in this quarterly essay we did was that I would love there to be a rule, which there won't be, but I'd love there to be a rule that you're not allowed to attack an argument unless you can articulate it in a manner that is recognisable to the person who holds it. It is so easy to attack an argument that is not recognisable to the person who holds it, that straw man thing, and we spend, I reckon, probably 85% of our time doing that. The other 15% we spend not engaging it at all. I think this is a real problem. And to pick up a thread that Scott left, the way I would say it is, this can only be possible when we become real to each other. That's Scott's point. I agree with that. But that requires, this may be an unpopular view in this moment, that requires a far greater range of apolitical space. I reckon there's a pretty clear correlation, it's just a hunch, between the degrading of our democratic exchanges, our public discourse, and the disappearance really of civil society organisations that existed for their own purposes, not for some other purpose, not to achieve some other end in capital J justice or, you know, some other social end, but they just, they are what they are, right? Pick whatever you want, bowling clubs, laughing clubs, whatever, where people can have the sort of solidaristic connections that democracy requires and presupposes without it being predetermined politically.
Yeah.
We have so little apolitical space, so little of it. At least people who are engaged in politics do. People who aren't engaged in politics probably have heaps of apolitical space, and they're the ones who probably make the right decision on election night because they're not paying attention. Probably they're the ones who save us. Anyway, that's enough from me. We have another question.
Hi, my name's Chris. I came down from Sydney to
be... Wow.
It seems to me that one of the key characteristics of our political moment is a breakdown of epistemology. So it's not just that we can't agree on a set of facts on which to conduct political debate, but we actually don't have a framework by which we could establish such facts. And without that, the wisdom of the crowd breaks down into who can shout the loudest and in the greatest number, while the underlying disagreements go undiscussed. And, you know, we can see this at play in a lot of the examples you gave last week, particularly referenda. So my question is, if we see this state of affairs as undesirable, which I think most of us in this room would, why does it continue? So do people not recognise that there are axiomatic disagreements underneath the surface level debate? Or do we see them and not think that they're important to discuss? Or maybe everyone sees exactly what's going on and they just like yelling at each other.
Wow. I know that was a joke at the end, but I think there's a lot to that. I really do. But I won't speak first. I'll hand it over. Stephanie, do you want to kick off?
I don't know. I mean, you asked, it's a why question, not a what do we do question. I'm not sure what the answer to the why question is. I mean, I would say, though, I think, again, I kind of want to blame the internet back in, I mean, this is a very common thing to say, this probably isn't news to people here, but back in the days where everyone watched the 6 o'clock news, we were all on the same page about what the facts were, right? Because we had a common source of knowledge, right? To put it in epistemic terms. I think the diversification of news sources is actually good for deliberation and democracy. But my pick is that that kind of the fact that we all get these personalized news feeds, Google results are personalized now, right? We all get pointed to different pages. We ask the same question and we get pointed to different pages on Google. I think that's a big source of why we're not on the same page about what the basic facts are. But that's just my guess.
Can I pick up two things that I think are pretty important? One off the back of what Stephanie just said. There was a common system of shared facts that we all had access to when we all watched a common news program at 6 o'clock each night, because there were editorial decisions about what was newsworthy and what was not, about what played well on the evening news and what didn't, about what were marginal issues or niche issues or issues for particular communities and what's for the mainstream. I think some of the collapse in some of our editorial decisions, I think editors are incredibly important. I think some of the collapse in editorial decisions being led far more by social media, what's trending there, rather than making very difficult editorial decisions, I think that's regrettable. I do think the fact that editors are no longer the sole gatekeeper for what becomes newsworthy. I think that cannot help but expand the world that we see, and we come to see the world through the eyes of others. That has benefits. That has tremendous drawbacks along the lines of what Stephanie just described. Bespoke media ecosystems. I don't know how to solve that. It's a problem.
Can I ask, I wasn't meaning to suggest that it's all a bad thing either. So again, diversification of media, I think, is great for the reasons you're pointing to, but... Yeah.
But it's interesting. I don't think we have diversification of media. I think what we have is personal curation of news or of information or of the world. That's, I think, a radically different thing, because that is about the tailoring of everything to taste.
You can, you could have a diversification of media without this algorithmization of media.
Exactly.
Okay. And that's right.
Right. And so, Chris, the reason I thought your joke at the end was actually probably... the bit that had the answer in it is that, and also the bit, the reason I think the answer isn't simply education, is we're here because we actually just want to be. We're here because the psychic rewards of the little actions that lead us down the path where we end up in these cul-de-sacs, you know, self-referentially discussing things with people who can share and amplify our outrage about something or whatever, or even our love for something. We're here because all those little decisions, all those little acts, we like. We're attracted to it. So there's something in the wiring of the human being that has been hacked, and we're submitting to it. Like we're submitting to it. We're getting a lot of assistance in that submission with the hacking, but we are also, like, I know lots of people who are upset at the state of discourse. I would argue 80 to 90% of them absolutely love getting torn into the people outside their echo chamber because it's fun, because they feel a sense of belonging, they feel a sense of, this is what I mean when I, it's part of what I mean when I say I think the problems end up being things that are not about rationality. They're matters of discipline. They're matters of the heart. There's something bigger at play there. And then it has epistemic consequences all the way down the line. I think this is kind of a point that, is it Neil Levi wrote this book a couple of years ago about, what's it called, bad opinions?
That's right.
Something like that. It's a really interesting analysis about why it is that groups of people end up holding bad opinions about things, by which he kind of means opinions where you are at odds with just about every expert in the area. Climate change, he gives us an example. Vaccine attitudes, he gives us another example, et cetera. And his whole argument he's unfolding is that people end up with these positions for rational reasons. And there's a whole thing about what that means. And so let's put that to one side for a moment. But one of the points that he goes via is that it is kind of a rational thing that we do to outsource our opinions on things where we cannot possibly have the expertise or process all the evidence to other people that we trust. What happens when the pool of people, this is me now, not him, where the pool of people that we trust gets narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower? Well, you can expect epistemic fracture. That's just the nature of it. And the thing about that pool shrinking to people who are more and more like us in some relevant way is that there's less friction. It's more fun. You'll get more reward. What you won't get is the reward that actually comes at the end of quite a lot of hard work of interacting with people who make you less comfortable. But the discomfort there, to go back to the point about civic spaces and apolitical spaces, that discomfort, we have a buffer for that. We have something that can ameliorate that. It's just that that requires a lot of interpersonal interaction, real world interaction. More effort, slightly less fun.
Let me just pick up one quick thing, then we'll get to our next question. Robert Talese, a fabulous political philosopher we've had on the show a couple of times, says that there are two forms of ignorance that afflict the crowds. One is what he calls belief ignorance. I thought I knew something that was true. It ended up not being true. That can be fixed pretty easily by information, education being set right. Then there's what he calls agent or agential ignorance, which is 98% of the people say this, this is probably true, I don't believe it. What is it that can cause someone to hold fast to something that probably isn't true? What, in other words, in Waleed's term, what is it that makes them enjoy holding on to something that probably isn't true? And I think one of the great things that we have done that is slowly but surely dissolving the conditions of our common life is that we've attached status, a kind of moral status, to being in possession of facts. Being factually accurate, following the science, has become a term of moral superiority, which means that one of the ways that we hold it over other people is by ridiculing them for their ignorance, ridiculing them for their, not just their belief ignorance, but for their moral malformation. And if there's one thing in this world that's going to cause someone to dig into a position that they hold, it's being ridiculed by people that they don't respect. So one of the many things that we can do, I think, to slowly heal the conditions of our common life is to stop treating morality as if it were a status symbol and to stop treating ignorance as if it's something that is a kind of zero-sum commodity and something that I can use as a weapon in order to subject other people to my superiority.
Or factual information as morality.
Or factual information totally as morality.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm not keeping track of who's up. Yes, thank you.
Hello, my name is Georgina. I have been quite interested in the different ways you're discussing the wisdom of the crowd. We've looked at a lot of democracy examples. We've looked at, and Waleed brought up a kind of sports like example, but that still gives you a for and against, and also the concept of how time needs to play into our decision processes. A kind of thought experiment or situation I think would be fun to hear your thoughts on how our conversations have played into is if we have a crowd at an open mic stand-up comedy club where all the comedians are totally unknown to the audience, so there's not a pre-existing buy-in, and that audience is deciding collectively as a group if that comedian is funny or not. How does our insights into the wisdom of the crowd play out in that scenario?
That's a really interesting question.
Comedy, oh my God. I mean, that's not going to be a case where reasons, I mean, no one likes having punchlines explained to them, right? That doesn't make a joke funny if you have to have the punchline explained to you. So I'm not sure deliberation is going to be what gets you the kind of deliberative stuff that I was talking about. All people sitting around a table and all sharing their reasons and listening to people outside their echo chambers, that's not going to get
that would be amazing. They all get together. Was that joke funny? Did you think that joke was funny?
Let's analyze the structure.
I thought that joke was funny.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even think what reasons you would give for finding a joke funny. I mean, I guess I'm maybe a bit more than these two, a subjectivist about some realms of truth, and maybe comedy is one of them. So I'm not sure that there are facts about what's funny. I think what's funny, there can be things that are funny to me and things that are funny to you, and they're just different, and I think that's just okay. I don't think there's some person-independent fact of the matter.
Well, except I do work with a lot of comedians. I have discussions about this sort of thing, not this scenario, but quite a lot. And I think in the end where comedians get to, and I trust them on this, I feel they're the experts, right? Yeah.
Well, we questioned that notion earlier, but go on.
I think they largely believe that the only test for whether something's funny is that people laugh, that there is nothing beyond that. And that's not a superficial position that the ones at least I've spoken to about this hold. They believe that. I've had really interesting conversations with people about what's the greatest, like, for example, Bohemian Rhapsody is the greatest song ever written. This is a fact. Okay. but what's the greatest piece of comedy ever? I had this conversation with a friend of mine, and I was nominating Who's On First as an example. Whether you think it's the one you laughed at most or whatever, my argument was, is this the greatest ever piece of comedy because it's timeless? Technically, it's superbly constructed. The performance is brilliant. You can watch it again and again and again, and it's funny. It's funny to just about everyone, anywhere in time and space. That's got to be it. And I had one comedian put me in my place on that in a really interesting way. And she said to me, that's completely the wrong criteria for comedy, because comedy is about the moment. So the thing that makes a piece of comedy brilliant is that it has distilled the moment and then offered an insight or a reflection or something that immediately makes people laugh in that moment. And the fact that that's not funny a week later doesn't count against it. It may count for it because it means they've mastered that particular moment. So to come to your particular example, I mean, inherent in that is that the wisdom of the crowd is absolute. They laugh. They're the ones in the moment in that place. They have decided that that's funny. However, Georgina, if you're asking a different question, and that is who's the best comedian, now that crowd's wisdom, I think, becomes hugely diluted because they're the final judgment on that moment. But who's the best comedian is a question about who can adapt to and find the right thing to say, the right piece of comedy in many moments. And there you would need an accumulation of crowds. And maybe that's how these things ultimately get judged. I don't know if that's a good answer, though. It's such an interesting question that I think it would require more
reflection. I think it's the John Stuart Mill answer. John Stuart Mill said that the only evidence that anything is desirable that can possibly be given is that people, in fact, desire it.
Yeah.
And I think there's really something, and he was saying desirable in general, not just funny,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Moral, you know, anything kind of desirability you want. So,
well, by that measure, doom scrolling is desirable, I guess. This is where we get it. We have a question.
Let's go right here.
Eric, with a question that we haven't really addressed yet. People take a long time to make up their minds. Pretty much every survey you see on like a yes, no question has a large chunk of undecided. And a lot of people say, I'll make up my mind on the day. Is that just part of an innate human condition that you don't want to commit to something? You just put it out there until you're forced to actually make a decision? And does that impact in Australia more because voting is compulsory?
Wow. Wonderful question. You know that the single most common modern criticism of the crowds, it's fallen out of fashion to refer to them as the unwashed, unless you're Waleed, or ignorant or herd-like. The single greatest criticism? Apathetic. The crowds are unengaged. So what this reflects is the way that we've come to think of the period in between elections as not really a time when people are taking in a lot of information, but a time during which people are forming impressions. Certain media moments will spike. Certain moments will go viral. That's the thing that sticks. And so maybe it's not so much inattentiveness, maybe it is inattentiveness, but it's more the kind of gradual accumulation of these impressions, and they're all floating there, and then the moment of decision comes. And it's really interesting, even for deliberative Democrats, deliberation can technically go on forever. Who's to know that you've reached a moment when, yes, this is the right answer? Even moments of deliberation have to come to an end. There has to be the moment of decision. Two of my big criticisms. One is the media is far too much in the thrall of big democratic events. We look for the big thing that's coming rather than the important things that happen in the meantime. This is actually one of the reasons I love Iris Murdoch. For Murdoch, when you make your moral decision, all of the hard work has already been done. You've become the sort of person who's going to make that decision when it comes time to making that decision. What you need to pay far more attention of is the kind of language that you use in between moral decisions. So I don't mind the time taking. I don't mind the free floating of all of these unreconciled observations, even impressions. A great deal of the judgments we make about everyday life aren't really factual as much as they are impressionistic. And I think those moments where it all gets sharpened, you can learn more about your situation and yourself, the kind of person you've become, the sort of things that your ears pricked up to at that moment of decision. I think the moment of decision is important, but I think the incidental observations, impressions that we gain along the way, those are the things that really make us the kind of people that we are.
Especially when multiplied by the crowds.
That's right.
The thing. So it's not one person's impression that don't. I've got a bad feeling about you. That's it. Off with your head. Okay, there's a problem there. But where it's 1,000 people going, I think that's a better leader than that one. I can't tell you exactly why. It's just a sense. It's amazing how often retrospectively you go, oh, they might have. Something comes out. They go, oh, I saw something here. Yeah.
Can I just hesitate? Can I just put a slight note of caution about impressions? I think the 3 to 5 years, depending on what country you're in, that you're taking between elections, it shouldn't just be wandering around, floating around, gathering impressions, and then on the day, oh, it turns out I'm the kind of person that votes this way. Your impression gathering should be somewhat deliberate, I think, just to...
Yes, it should be. But we don't know what it will be that catalyzes those different impressions into a solid picture. And what it is that catalyzes, it can be serendipity. It can be chance. It can be a gaffe. And then suddenly everything crystallizes around that moment. I don't know if it's dangerous. I think it can be.
The Mark Latham handshake.
Yes.
An example of that.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Where are we up to?
Right. Hello, Philip. So I wanted to kind of bring in a little bit of epistemological combo education into this because there's a practice that probably if there are teachers here, they'll probably know about where you practice social constructivism within the classroom, which basically means we agree as a collective what is knowledge, what we are learning about. And something that's very interesting there is I might be running around in the classroom and there's this group over here, this group over here, this group over here, and they all come up with these different sorts of ideas and knowledge that comes out of it, and everyone is correct. Every single one of those students is correct because we've done it in a context where there isn't a single objective truth. And I think the interesting thing there is that only works where you have the teacher there that is willing to facilitate but be aside. They enable those little crowds to generate their wisdom. And I think that's the thing that kind of connects with your point earlier about, you know, that crafted sort of collaborative deliberation. And I guess what I'm curious about is how can we create more spaces like that? How do we create more spaces where the facilitation is there so the knowledge can arise without it being muddied out or people told, no, you're not allowed to think that thing?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think so much work in democratic theory at the moment is trying to figure out exactly how to structure things like these mini publics, these groups of 200 to 300 people, how to structure them such that the right answers, because we're kind of questioning whether there kind of is a right answer in these contexts, but such that they kind of deliberate in a way that leads them to an overall collective decision that generates what we call loser's consent, right? So if you're on the losing end, you can accept the decision. And it's actually interesting, I think in some of these mini publics that have happened, they start off with quite a strong facilitator role because everyone's just sort of showed up, they don't know what's happening. And then by about day two or three or four, the participants really want to take control of the process. And I think that's cool. So I think it's got to be fluid and it requires a lot of experimentation. And I doubt that there's any one answer that's going to apply across all political issues, would be my guess. What?
Can I add one tiny thing to it? The other part of the social constructivism thing is, this is the basis upon which we proceed together. So one of the things that Willie and I wrote about in the quarterly essay on contempt and democracy is that for any of this stuff that we're talking about to work, part of the basis upon which we proceed together is our going on together is more important than any one side winning. This is one of the reasons that right towards the end of the essay, we use the marriage analogy. There comes that moment in any significant relationship where you know that you can pull out the trump card, that you can win the argument that the two of you are having. You can pull something out of your past or you can go someplace that presses just the right button. You know you can win that argument. And you know that by winning the argument, you can lose everything else that's important. This is one of the forms of self-regulation that we engage in. The relationship is more important than what might happen in this particular argument. So part of life together, part of discovering the democratic conditions of our common life, is setting off from a point where we believe that if we are ruled over by others with whom we disagree, it's not the end of the world. That just because we've lost this time around, it doesn't mean we can't mobilize and do something different next time. And above all else, one of the basis upon which we proceed is it's better for us to go on together than for one side to simply be vanquished.
That, I'm afraid, brings us to the end. So I'm afraid, yes. I boo, yes. Sadly, your boos are not heard. Completely beside the point. This is not a crowd-based decision. Thank you for coming along. It's been wonderful to see your faces, but also to hear your questions. Because when Scott and I do this show, it really is just us and then the guest of the week. But you can't interrupt. You can't jump in. You can't steer us actually to what would have been a far more interesting discussion if only we knew. It's very rare that we get this sort of chance. So thank you. I will admit to some trepidation coming here tonight because, let's be honest, most Q&As are not great. people get to the mic, they give a speech, they sit down, and then if you have a question, it's like, do you agree with the manifesto I've just read out? But I should never have doubted a Mindfield crowd would be so much more thoughtful than that, so much more deliberative, discursive, would actually latch onto the ideas discussed and take us to places that we hadn't thought of and so on. So I want to say thank you, the studio audience, for being here. Thank you, the audience listening on the radio machine or on their podcast, who I'm sure would have been just as great if you were in person. This event was booked out very quickly, so a lot of people couldn't be here who wanted to be. Thank you, Stephanie, for helping us out and taking us through an incredibly rich and complex sort of topic and steering us through the minefield.
An absolute joy, as always.
And Scott, you are all right. Well done. So that's it for the Mindfield this week. Stephanie Collins, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Monash University. Her most recent book is Organisations as Wrongdoers, From Ontology to Morality. If ever a book title was made by the Mindfield, that is it. So Stephanie, thank you so much for helping us out this week. And we'll see you next in more normal settings.
And that wraps up our wonderful little experiment where we got to meet many of our Mindfield listeners. We got the opportunity to speak with many of you, to learn a great deal from you. It was a wonderful event, and it was so good, in fact, that I think we're going to have to do it again. Thanks to everyone who came out to Melbourne to be with us, who participated so energetically in the conversation and had such wonderful things to say. Next week, we are returning to our annual Ramadan series. It's a special period of heightened attentiveness to certain practices that undergird not just the moral life, but also our capacity to live together in a manner that is distinctly human, that is peaceable, and that pays proper respect to the world in which we live. We've got a very special show in store for you next week where we'll explain what's to come. I hope you'll join us then.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.